You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko joul toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Joel, covering for Wire host Caster and producer Faith, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aka nei, coming up on the show, for their science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, chats with us about the importance of uranium-235. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, Caster asks about New Zealand's exit from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance and new systems in place for ADHD diagnoses. I speak to Make It 16 member and youth MP for Eland, Sam Allen, about a majority of youth MPs backing calls to lower the voting age in both local and general elections. And I speak to the Northland Regional Manager for Forest and Bird, Dean Bajent Mercer, about a recently conducted NIWA-led study that shows Aotearoa's native forests are absorbing substantially more carbon dioxide than previously thought. He aho whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, or I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Waiamai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei, kōrero ano hei pakihiri roki roki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o irangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That we are, and we are joined this week by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Why are you laughing
sorry,
over there?
Every time you say that word, I just have to laugh. But
yeah, what, expert?
Anyway, yes. That's
but you are our expert.
Oh, well, yeah, okay.
I mean, you're definitely the expert in this situation because I know absolutely nothing about chemistry or essentially what uranium-235 is, but I've heard it's quite big.
And
it's a big moment.
Well, indeed it is. And we're sort of departing from the usual structure of Dear Science today, where we normally do three stories, but I figured that, you know, last week, or the last couple of weeks or whatever, when certain people have been sort of bombing the crap out of certain places to stop them gaining nuclear weapons and everything, and this thing, uranium-235, cropped up quite a bit. So I thought, let's dedicate the whole show to a little bit of a discussion about what this exactly is and why it's so damn important.
Yep. Okay. Absolutely.
So in order to do that, we have to start at the very beginning.
Yes, please do.
Which, as Julie Andrews once said, is a very good place to start. If you get that
I don't
reference.
Get that.
Oh, God, you're Look. So young, Joe. You're so young.
I probably
Dear
should get
God.
It.
God, you've never seen The Sound of Music. Come on.
I've never seen The Sound of Music. I know what you're talking about, at least, when you say The Sound of Music. I'm not that young. Actually, it's funny. In my first year of university back in 2020, I did have a professor ask me if we knew what 9/11 was, which is quite interesting.
Oh, sheesh. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, just wanted to drop that out there. But anyway, you carry
right.
on.
Okay. So let's kick off. We're going to talk about uranium today, and in particular uranium-235. And what does this 235 mean? Hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a little bit of a gleaning as to what it's all about. So uranium itself is a metal. It's element number 92 on the periodic table, and it was discovered in 1789, way back when, by a German chemist by the name of Martin Klaproth, and he discovered essentially the mineral pitch blend, okay, which those of you who know anything about the Curies might have heard of, possibly. But in chemical terms, it's a compound called uranium dioxide, okay? So the actual metal itself, uranium metal, wasn't isolated pure until 1841. And people didn't sort of see anything unusual about anything to do with uranium at the time. However, in 1896, Louis Becquerel, who was a French chemist, he sort of really changed the world with his discovery. And his discovery was radioactivity.
Mm.
And we all have heard the word radioactivity. We possibly might not really understand what it's all about. And so here comes the lesson. And what Becquerel did, it was totally by accident. X-rays had been discovered the year before, 1895. And so these rays thing were all a big deal. You know, people were trying to find out what else would give off these rays, okay? And so Becquerel was doing some experiments with photographic plates and covering them in black paper and then putting things on them and seeing if they left an image on the photographic plate as a result of these so-called rays.
Mm.
And his idea was that if you expose these things to the sun, they'd gain energy from the sun, you put them on this photographic plate, and then they'll transfer that energy and make an image in themselves and blah, blah, blah. But it was foggy in Paris one weekend that he was going to do this particular experiment. And so he didn't expose these things to the sun. He just left them sitting on a plate in a desk drawer or something over the weekend, came back after the weekend and found that there was an image on the plate. And he thought, oh, hang on, what's going on here? I didn't expose these things to the sun. Where have these rays come from? And it just so happened that the thing that he left on the plate were uranium salts.
Right, okay? Right.
And so he eventually figured out that uranium must be giving out some sort of radiation somehow that would cause a fog on a photographic plate. And that was the start of radioactivity, okay? And so one of the first people in the radioactivity study area were the Curies, so Pierre and Marie. And so they eventually ended up winning the Nobel Prize for their studies of radioactivity. And, of course, they famously isolated both radium and polonium, which were other radioactive metals. And then also in on the deal here was Ernest Rutherford. So there's our Kiwi connection. He won the Nobel Prize in 1908 in chemistry, not for splitting the atom, which he never actually did, but for explaining what radioactivity was. And he said that radioactivity was, in fact, the atom falling apart. Okay. Now, the actual word atom comes from the Greek for not cut or indivisible.
Right.
People have thought that atoms were the smallest possible states of matter, you know, that everything was built up from. Rutherford showed that wasn't true, and Rutherford showed that the atom could in fact disintegrate, okay? And what Rutherford also showed that the atom was made up of a positively charged middle, which he called the nucleus, and the electrons sort of floating around. And the nucleus is a really important part of the story, because this is where all the whole radioactivity bit comes from. So we have this nucleus, it's positively charged. Rutherford showed that it contained very, very, very small particles called protons that had the positive charge. And then later, although Rutherford foresaw it, he showed that the nucleus also contained these things called neutrons, which are about the same size as a proton, but they're neutral. Okay, so no charge at all. Right, so why is this so important? Well, elements are elements because of the number of protons in their nucleus. Hopefully you're staying with me here, everybody, okay? So, every hydrogen atom in the universe has got one proton in its nucleus. Every chlorine atom in the universe has got 17 protons in its nucleus. Every uranium atom in the universe has got 92 protons in its nucleus, okay? So, the number of protons in the nucleus determines the identity of the atom, essentially. And we know of 118 different types of atoms at the moment. And, obviously, that goes all the way from hydrogen, which has one, to, God, what's 118? Tennessinium or no, Moscovium or something. Anyway, 118 protons in the nucleus. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Now, if we study hydrogen very, very carefully, we'll find that all of the hydrogen atoms in the universe aren't exactly the same. So roughly one in about 6,000 hydrogen atoms has twice the mass of a normal hydrogen atom. And those hydrogen atoms contain one proton and one neutron in the nucleus. Now, normal hydrogen atoms only got one proton in the nucleus, no neutrons, okay? So these different forms of hydrogen, this different form of hydrogen that occurs one in 6,000 atoms, we call deuterium, okay? Now, it behaves pretty similarly to hydrogen, pretty much. It's still hydrogen because it's still got one proton in the nucleus, but it's got that extra neutron that makes it heavier.
Mm.
And we call this an isotope. Okay, which again is a word that you might be familiar with, you may have heard in the media, okay? So isotopes are atoms that have got the same number of protons but different numbers of neutrons in the nucleus, okay? And so there's a whole heap of different isotopes out there. Now, we're talking about uranium, And uranium just happens to have three naturally occurring isotopes. Okay. Now, as I said before, all uranium atoms have got 92 protons in the nucleus. Okay. We have uranium atoms that have different numbers of neutrons in the nucleus. So we've got three isotopes. We've got what we call uranium-238, okay? We've got uranium-235, and we've got uranium-234. And so they have all got different numbers of neutrons in the nucleus. So those are three isotopes of uranium. Now, uranium-238, boring. pretty dumb. It's radioactive, okay? All of these forms of uranium are radioactive. That's an important thing, okay? So, in other words, they are going to be decaying naturally, okay? That's a natural process. You can't stop it, okay? And so we've got uranium-238, which makes up, of all the uranium on the planet, makes up about 99.3%. We've got uranium-235... ding, ding, which makes out about 0.7% of all the uranium on the planet. And you've got uranium-234, which is in trace amounts, so we don't really worry about that, okay? Now, as I said, they're all radioactive and they all decay. And eventually, if you leave them long enough, and by long enough, we're talking 10 to the 5 years, 10 to the 8 years, and 10 to the 9 years for those three isotopes. So like a billion years for uranium-238. Half of it will have turned into something else. And eventually you leave it long enough, they all end up as lead. Okay? And they all stop at lead. So that's your natural radioactive decay process. However, uranium-235 is special because it is what's called a fissile nucleus. And that means that we can actually induce breakage of the nucleus.
Right.
Okay? And in so doing, we release a buttload of energy, okay, unimaginable amounts of energy as a result of fission of the uranium nucleus. And this only happens for uranium-235. And the way that we can induce this fission is to hit it with neutrons, okay? And so these neutrons have to be traveling at a particular speed. Too fast and they just sort of go straight through and they don't interact. Too slow, they don't sort of interact at all. You've got to get it just right, okay? And then if you hit them with these neutrons of these particular speed and energy, then the nucleus breaks apart and it forms a bunch of much lighter elements. It can break into two, it can break into three. But really critically, and no pun intended, what also happens there is that neutrons, a couple of neutrons get emitted in that process as well. And those neutrons, if they're traveling at the right speed, they can then hit a neighboring 235 nucleus, and they can cause that to split with the ejection of a couple of neutrons, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we have a chain reaction, which again is an integral part of this whole sort of nuclear weapons thing. We talk about chain reactions.
Yeah.
And the chain reaction just happens really, 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 really fast, and you're getting an enormous amount of energy liberated in a very, very short time span, and bam, there's essentially your nuclear weapon. Okay. Now, so uranium-235 is basically the only naturally occurring isotope that does this, that is present in any great extent. Okay. Now, you might not think that 0.7% of all the uranium is any great extent, and you're right, it's not a heck of a lot. So what they have to do in order to make this useful, okay, you can't just take sort of natural uranium and pick out the uranium-235. That's you just can't do that. You've got this mixture of the uranium isotopes, and just treating that with neutrons doesn't get you anywhere. You need a certain enrichment level. You need to get the 235 content up from 0.7% up to around about 3.5% if you want to use this uranium for nuclear power. Okay?
Yeah.
So around about 3.5% enrichment is what you need for nuclear power. So, and we know all about nuclear power stations, okay? They're they're fairly safe except for when they're not.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is a controlled fission of the uranium nuclei there, okay? And it's all rigorously controlled, et cetera, et cetera. If it gets away on you, you know, probably the worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to have an explosion, not a nuclear explosion per se. It's probably going to be hydrogen or something like that. And it's, you know, big explosion, and you're going to liberate radioactive material, as we saw in Fukushima.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But as you know, you're not going to get a mushroom cloud, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's not going to happen. Now, in order to get a mushroom cloud, what you need is about 90% enrichment.
Okay.
So you need to take that 0.7% of uranium-235 and you need to enrich it to 90%.
Mm.
How the heck do you do that?
Yeah.
Right. So, getting back to the chemistry, uranium-238, so that's 99.3%, uranium-235, about 0.7%. Now, uranium-235 is about a percent and a half, so lighter than uranium-238, okay?
Yeah.
Now, if you've got gas molecules, heavier molecules travel more slowly than light molecules, okay? And so you can make use of that to separate the heavy molecules from the light molecules. And what they do is that they use a thing called a centrifuge, okay? And a centrifuge is just basically a big spinning arm, essentially,
yeah.
Okay? And in a centrifuge, the heavier things are going to get thrown to the end of the centrifuge more rapidly than the light things, okay? So then the question is, how do we do this with uranium? How do we make use of this with uranium? We use a special compound of uranium called uranium hexafluoride, or UF6, okay? And UF6 is a solid at room temperature, but you heat it to 50 degrees and it turns into a gas. And there you go. You've now got uranium hexafluoride. You've got the uranium-238 and 235 in now a gaseous form. And if you stick these in these centrifuges and spin them at around about 50 to 70,000 RPM, which is quite quick, you're going to get a slight separation of the heavy from the light. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be slight. And then so you're going to be a little bit enriched, shall we say. And then you can take that enriched and you can throw it in another centrifuge and do it again and do it again and do it again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay? Yeah.
And eventually, if you keep doing that, then you're going to get up to whatever percent enrichment you want. The trouble is that this is seriously complicated kit, very, very complicated machinery, okay? And so this, I believe, is what was being targeted in the bombing of Iran with these centrifuges, okay, which were situated well below ground, seemingly. And this is what Iran was purportedly using to enrich their uranium, okay?
Yeah.
So that's basically the story. That's why uranium-235, the isotope, is so important, because it's the only isotope that you can use to make nuclear weapons. Now, that's not absolutely true, because you can also use uranium-238 and turn it into plutonium-239,
yeah,
which is also a fissile nucleus as well. So that does the same thing as uranium-235. But in terms of naturally occurring things, that's uranium-235 is your one, okay? So basically, you can take a ton of natural uranium, and if you want to make weapons-grade uranium out of that, you're going to get around about 5.6 kilos of weapons-grade uranium-235 out of that ton.
Right.
And to make a bomb, apparently you need around about, gosh, I think it was, I can't remember, I think it was about 16 kilos, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So you don't need a heck of a lot.
Yeah, but which is kind of concerning.
but it's the act of getting it. You know,
It's
an extraordinarily difficult thing to get.
And
the question then becomes, okay, so these centrifuges are highly, highly specialized pieces of equipment that will be made only by certain people on the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
Who gave Iran the centrifuges? Okay. And I seem to recall many years ago as well, Libya also were ordering some centrifuges from somebody. Now, these are things that you think would be very, very, very carefully regulated and everything, hopefully by the UN or whatever, but you know, because you don't want everyone having these, because they're an absolute necessity when it comes to enriching uranium. So
that was a great lesson into everything. I feel like I just learned so much chemistry, and more chemistry I've learned than my entire schooling, to be honest with you.
So there will be a test.
Okay. I'll listen to the podcast, which is available on 95bfm.com after the show. But thank you very much, Professor Alan Blackman taken aback. Thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Thank you,
MOTAT. And thank you, science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Listen to your radio. Nuclear explosions are caused by weapons such as H-bombs or atom bombs. They are like ordinary explosions, only many times more powerful. They cause great heat and blast. They also make a cloud of deadly dust which falls slowly to the ground. This is what is called fallout. So these are the two dangers.
If you hear the fallout warning,
heat and blast, after and followed by
and the ball clear has been
sung, the heat and blast arose from the air and see the nearest and best cover as quickly as you are or under 5 miles from the explosion.
Knows a spot?
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tappy place.
It's music.
95BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
Welcome back to The Wire.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Tom Rutherford.
Last week, Climate Change Minister Simon Watts announced the government's decision for New Zealand to exit the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance. The organisation was formed in 2021 by countries and other stakeholders to discuss the phase-out of fossil fuels in favour of more environmentally friendly fuel sources. The decision to leave the alliance follows the repeal of the ban on oil and gas exploration, which the government says is a necessary decision to ensure we have the necessary resources to transition towards more environmentally friendly fuel sources. The Green Party has criticised the move, saying it undermines our international reputation as a frontrunner on environmental issues and our personal commitments to combating climate change. The government has also announced upcoming changes to ADHD diagnoses, allowing general practitioners or GPs to diagnose ADHD and prescribe medication. The change follows long wait times and difficult processes for children and adults with ADHD to access a diagnosis or the necessary medication. In our weekly catch-up with the National Party's Tom Rutherford, Tuesday Wire host Castor asked about each of these issues, beginning with the departure from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance.
Why did New Zealand sign up to the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance in the first place?
Yeah, that was a decision made in 2021, is my understanding. Made by the previous government, and we've made the decision that New Zealand has and will continue to have one of the most renewable electricity sectors in the world. But we've also committed to our climate targets and our international climate obligations. But as we undertake our energy transition towards lower emissions fuels, natural gas will definitely play an important role in the stability of the system until viable alternatives are in place. And so we've repealed the ban on offshore oil and gas exploration, and we've set aside a tag contingency of $200 million over 4 years for co-investment in new gas fields through Budget 2025.
Yeah, so why have we left the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance now?
On this basis of both falling domestic production presenting a real risk to our future energy needs, the government had been looking at all options to extend the supply of gas as a critical energy source, and with the repealing of the ban on oil and gas, as I just mentioned, and the setting aside of tag contingency for co-investment in new gas fields, we decided to withdraw our associate membership of the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, and that was communicated to the Secretariat of the Alliance on the 21st of June.
Last year, Climate Change Minister Simon Watts said we wouldn't necessarily have to leave the agreement despite repealing the oil and gas ban. What's changed since then?
Yeah, I can't speak on behalf of for the Minister in particular to those comments, but what I can say was the catalyst for leaving the Alliance was our decision to repeal the previous government's ban on offshore oil and gas exploration. We are still committed to our climate targets, so as we undertake our energy transition towards lower emissions fuels, natural gas will play an important role in the stability of the system until we find viable alternatives. And so we joined the Alliance back at the Glasgow Summit in 2021, and with this change towards our repeal of the oil and gas ban, we didn't think being an associate member was the right thing to be doing.
If we're considering our international reputation with regards to our clean green identity and our goals to become emissions free moving forward, does this undermine our image internationally?
No, so the government notified the Alliance members in June that the repeal of the oil and gas ban was coming and removing ourselves from the group. We then had the Ministry for Foreign Affairs and Trade communicate the decision in advance to Pacific countries, and we haven't received any negative feedback from other countries on our move. Being an associate member, as New Zealand was, required working to end subsidies for oil and gas and ending public finance for development. And so we haven't had any negative feedback from any of our partners or any of our international colleagues on the decision that we've made.
Will there be any other groups or agreements that the New Zealand government or New Zealand as a country has signed up to regarding reducing emissions or regarding improving our climate impact that might be exited now that we've repealed the ban on oil and gas?
I am not in a position to be able to answer that. That's not a no or a yes. It's just to say that I'm not aware if that's likely to happen in the future or not, and I think that would be a question best put to the minister directly himself.
Moving on to the ADHD diagnosis changes, the government recently announced changes to how it can be diagnosed in New Zealand. What are the changes and why are they coming about now?
Yeah, so last week the Minister for Mental Health, Matt Ducey, welcomed the changes that would enable GPs and nurse practitioners to diagnose and treat adults with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is ADHD. This means from February next year, New Zealanders will have faster access to assessments and treatment for ADHD. And this is really a great step forward for timely access to support and for system efficiency. A number of our GPs and nurse practitioners are already working really closely with psychiatrists to treat ADHD, so they already have the skills to manage this work. And the Ministry of Health is working with sector representatives to develop a clinical principles framework for the assessment and treatment of ADHD, and this will ensure that there's quality and consistency for supporting patients with ADHD in New Zealand.
Yeah. Will there be additional training or measures put forward for GPs to ensure that people get a trustworthy diagnosis and to ensure that those are aligned with the diagnoses that people may have had previously from psychiatrists?
Yeah, so as I said, the Ministry of Health is working with sector representatives to develop a clinical principles framework for the assessment and treatment of ADHD, and this will ensure that there is quality and consistency for supporting patients with ADHD. There have been many advocates with lived experience who have spent years advocating for this change, and these changes will have a really positive impact on many people's ability to access what is often life-changing medicines.
That was the National Party's Tom Rutherford speaking about plans to scrap the nationwide speaking about the move away from the oil and gas alliance and changes to ADHD diagnoses.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Tom Rutherford.
This is why we should never put celebrities in charge of any... Oh, wait.
The Wire.
A majority of youth MPs across the political spectrum are calling for the current voting age to be decreased for local and general elections, allowing 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote. These youth MPs have also signed an open letter calling for the voting age to be lowered. This follows the Supreme Court's 2022 ruling that the current voting age of 18 discriminates against 16 and 17-year-olds, with the decision made on the grounds listed in the Human Rights Act 1993. A bill to allow 16 to 17-year-olds to vote in local elections had previously passed its first reading in August in 2023, but was axed by the government last year. I spoke to Make It 16 member and youth MP for Elam, Sam Allen, about lowering the voting age and what it means to have young voices represented in local and general elections. We've seen a petition from the youth MPs to lower the current voting age, similar to petitions we've also seen in the past from previous youth parliaments. Why is this issue coming up again and again?
It's coming up again and again because the politicians are again and again refusing to take action. Like, it was in 2022 when there was a declaration of inconsistency declared that said that it is actively violating the rights of young people set out in the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act to be able to be enfranchised in our democratic system. And so I would love to be able to stop having to talk about this issue if the government just did what they should do and enfranchised the young people that should be able to have their voices heard.
If we're thinking about giving people aged 16 to 17 the vote, what kind of benefits could that have for our democracy?
So we know from a large number of overseas countries, such as Scotland, that when you are able to give 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote, you're able to get them to vote in the initial instance. And that's really important because when we look across the board at the low turnout in things such as local elections, where it currently sat at around 40% at the last cycle, when we can get people to vote early, we can get them to vote often and therefore make voting a lifelong habit. And that's really important in terms of making sure that young people aren't just represented now, but into the future. I also think that principally, it's really important to make sure that as many voices within our democratic system can be heard, and therefore politicians are able to take into account the actions of the most number of people.
Young people bring a unique perspective to voting and many relevant issues, which you can already see with trends around voters aged 18 to 25. What are the primary issues important to 16 and 17-year-olds right now?
So I think 16 and 17-year-olds have a lot of common issues with people in different age groups, right? Like they care deeply about things like the cost of living through things like housing. But there are also a lot of unique issues that the fact that young people are yet to live out most of their life that they do care deeply about. Things like student issues through things like housing, things like climate change, things like mental health. And I think that only when you do get these young voices that uniquely experience these issues to such a great extent, are you able to really get those issues being dealt with?
There's often pushback on lowering the voting age from some political parties and figures who say that advocates for this change only want it to increase the parliamentary presence of parties who tend to be more popular with young people, such as the Greens. Is this a fair criticism?
I would say two things. I think firstly, that claim is often shown to just not be true, because when we look at the open letter that we have put out for this youth parliament, it has been signed by members from every party that is currently represented in our parliament. And our members come from all ends of the political spectrum. The people at this youth parliament calling for fair representation for young people exist on all ends of the political spectrum. But I think that secondly, it's actually important to be able to have young people represented, because that means that these parties who might currently not be popular with young people are more incentivized to take actions that support young people. And so that way you are able to influence what is being discussed to a degree where now, instead of just having some parties which are popular with young people because they, you know, might care about their interests to a greater degree, you just get every party in parliament that more so reaches out to young people, cares about their unique issues and all of that.
There's also a common concern around lowering the voting age that says we should just let kids be kids, for example, or that they're not responsible enough to vote. Are these criticisms just justified?
I don't think those criticisms are justified, because at the point in time where, like, young people are facing these issues, when we're watching a planet burn, when we're watching the highest youth suicide rate in the OECD, I don't think that kids can be kids under those conditions. And importantly, it is only by being able to get their voices and have a seat at the table are we able to fix those issues and actually let kids be kids based on that. And so, importantly, the only way under which we can get better, lives for young people, to let them enjoy their youth, is to be able to fix these issues, which only can be done by giving 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote. I also think that on the claim that, 16 and 17-year-olds aren't responsible, A, that's not unique to young people. I think that you know, there are some 30-year-olds that are irresponsible. There are some 80-year-olds that are irresponsible. And I think that broadly it is quite harmful to claim that an entire group of our society just is irresponsible. But I think that a lot of the responsibilities that young people have do make them quite responsible people. These are people that work. These are people that pay taxes. These are people that, you know, are studying to get, you know, might be studying to get a better life for themselves, might be, you know, in a trade or at a, you know, or working a full-time job. And so I think that that does give a high level of maturity and responsibility that I don't think is recognised by our political leaders.
That was Make It 16 and Youth MP Sam Allen on calls to lower the voting age in local and general elections. We'll be right back after the short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Down.
Sangria by Vera Allen, and before that you had See You by Dinosaur Jr. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Recently, new NIWA-led research has shown that Aotearoa's native forests are absorbing substantially more carbon dioxide than previously thought. This has raised concerns that the government is not doing enough to regulate pests that are harming native forest carbon sinks. I spoke to the Northland Regional Manager for Forest and Bird, Dean Bajant Mercer, about this and what the government is doing regarding these concerns. To start, as a sort of general question here, why do our forests absorb carbon dioxide?
Our native forests are constantly sinking carbon because they are photosynthesizing. So they are locking in carbon in a 24-hour cycle usually. And it's just what trees do. You know, as trees grow, they stack on carbon, like stacking on weight, as the trunks of the trees grow thicker and thicker. And so that's basically, native forests are standing carbon sinks, but they are under pressure because if those trees are attacked by possums, for example, that kill the trees, then that carbon is then released back into the atmosphere.
How much carbon dioxide is being absorbed? What are we seeing come from this new NIWA-led research?
The new groundbreaking NIWA research has shown that basically 171 million tonnes of carbon dioxide is being locked into native forests each year. And we didn't know that information a few years ago. We knew that there was this mysterious carbon sink that was really actively putting on new carbon at the bottom of the South Island, and which was a really big surprise because the forests there, they're called climax forests. That means that they are as old as they generally could be, and so it was thought they couldn't stack on any more carbon, but they were. So this research is a follow-up to that finding to see what else was happening. The surprise finding is that nationally, 171 million tonnes of carbon is being stacked on each year.
How do pest animals contribute to our native forests absorbing carbon dioxide?
Way back in the 1800s, there were these groups set up called acclimatisation societies, and they introduced animals, all sorts of animals from all around the world to Aotearoa because they saw the native forest as an empty Eden, empty of large animals. And so they introduced possums to start with, and then they introduced all sorts of deer from countries, you know, North America, the UK, from Bali, from Japan. And so they took up different parts of the forest, and they're all browsing animals, so they're like eating leaves and vegetation. So possums, it was basically free food. They were in the native forest. There were lots of plants that couldn't protect themselves from possums, and so possums started eating from the top, forest from the top down, so they were eating rata and all sorts of really important forest trees. And after about 50 years of being in a forest, they're at quite heavy saturation levels, and that's where you see a collapse start to happen. At the same time, from the bottom of the forest, you have deer running around, and they are eating seedlings, and they can also eat bark. They can strip bark off trees because, you know, deer have rumens, they have two stomachs, and so they are able to process and get energy out of quite a lot of different things, including leaf litter. And so what you've got with these animals together is stacking of pests in the forest, and there can also be other animals like pigs and goats, and so they start preventing a future native forest from growing that's really diverse, like it was in the first place. And you've got possums eating from the top down. So the problem is that these animals altogether restricting the amount of carbon that can be locked in to current standing forests and are eating the future native forests. And the more complex, naturally complex native forests are, which are rainforests, with all these different levels, from, you know, huge ancient trees to lower canopies to tree ferns to shrubs on the floor of the forest, that is a huge multi-tiered carbon sink. But these animals, over time, rip that apart and make it less and less sophisticated and able to take in the maximum and natural amounts of carbon that they could otherwise stack on.
Are current pest controls enough to mitigate the amount of carbon dioxide being absorbed?
We have a huge, huge problem in this country because the amount of pest control being done is nothing like what is necessary to protect native forest carbon sinks. You know, there are some successful aerial 1080 operations, and they target possums, rats, and then the bycal of that is usually a feral cat, stoats, ferrets, and weasels. So it's very, very good for predators, but it's not targeted at goats or deer, because to keep those numbers down, you need to use completely different methods. Also, the aerial 1080 operations cover quite a small percentage of native forests, and there's a lot of trapping that's going on all around the country, but we're nowhere near at keeping up with the level to protect native forests nationwide, let alone even a small percentage of them. And if we want to protect our biodiversity and our carbon sinks, we really need to ramp that up.
We also recently saw the Game Animal Herds of Special Interest Amendment Bill pass its first reading. If this were to be implemented into law, how much of an impact would this have on our native forests and carbon dioxide absorption?
Well, what we're seeing is the rise of hunting interests in the hunting industry, saying that they will step in and help with pest control. And it sounds like a really good kind of romantic idea, but really, the interests are for hunters rather than for conservation and carbon sinks. What's being proposed are called herds of significant interests, which would give some of those animals that were introduced, like different types of deer or goats, as in the Himalayan tar, which is a mountain goat, special protections so that hunters could manage their numbers for whatever outcomes that they would like. And that's really different from what the environment needs. Our argument is, you know, if you're going to look after different habitats, you first stand back and say, what does the forest need to be healthy? And then when you come from that approach, you come out with the different actions at the end, which is really, really different from if you take a hunter-led approach. There have been different forests around the country, such as the Kawaka Forest, that has had hunters managing the seeker deer there for some time. And it's really, really shocking in terms of the outcomes that we've seen. We haven't seen any successful long-term hunter management in this country. And that's because, you know, the focus isn't conservation. That's why looking after DOC and making sure the Department of Conservation is well-resourced and strategic can really turn around the fate of native forests and get them back to be both healthy carbon sinks and bring back our native biodiversity. There's a famous Australian ecologist called Dr. Tim Flannery, and he points out that to solve the climate crisis, you also need to solve the biodiversity crisis. So in terms of the temperate rainforest we have in this country, we need to do really good pest control that brings back native forest carbon sinks to life and allows them to stack on as much carbon as possible each year.
You've briefly touched on this throughout the interview, but what actions would you want the government to take?
Currently, the government is attacking as much environmental legislation and protections as possible. What we need is a government that has integrity in terms of looking after carbon sinks and looking after nature. And that means well-resourced work all around the country via DOC, but also through another kind of Jobs for Nature scheme. What we saw previously in terms of Jobs for Nature was an amazing array of work all around the country that protected nature and people's different rohi using different means. And so supporting that kind of work really had a massive bang for buck. And we need to have people at place looking after the environments that they're responsible for.
That was Forest and Birds Dean Bajant-Mercer on new NIWA-led research into Aotearoa's native forests, absorbing more carbon dioxide than previously thought.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Professor Alan Blackman, National's Tom Rutherford, Make It 16 Sam Allen, and Forest and Birds Dean Bajant-Mercer. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana, thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.